Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith and you want to call in to talk about them. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. I just might tell you we have lines open right now. Not all of them are open, but several lines are open, and you could get through if you call quickly before they fill up. And we're going to go directly to the phones right now and talk to Randall from Tacoma, Washington. Randall, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Steve. I just wondered, I keep hearing all these rumors about us going to a cashless society. And if that is true, is that found anywhere in the Bible other than like the mark of the beast?
No, there's no mention in the Bible of a cashless society. Even the mark of the beast does not mention a cashless society. What it does say is that if people don't take the mark, they cannot buy or sell. Why would that be? Well, some people have decided, well, that's because there will be a cashless society and the mark of the beast will replace cash as a purchasing platform, that you'd be more like a credit, that's maybe a credit number that's put on your hand or forehead or put into a chip under the skin so that they just scan that at the point of purchase and you don't use cash anymore. Now, that could happen, but certainly Revelation 13, where we read of that, doesn't mention anything remotely like a cashless society. It just says that if you don't comply, everybody's required to comply on pain of death, and if you don't comply, you won't be able to participate in commerce. Now, I suppose one reason for that could be a cashless society, and I've always believed that our world is moving toward a cashless society. I mean, it's obvious that they're trying to go toward an all-digital currency now and so forth, and I've believed for over 50 years that that's no doubt the direction that the world is going, but I don't see it in the Bible. It doesn't. There's no reference to a cashless society. Other reasons that a person without the mark might not be able to buy or sell would be that people are persecuting them because they're not complying with the standards that everyone else is going along with. It'd be like, for example, if you were not able to, go into public places, take airplane flights, and do things if you didn't have, let's just say, the vaccine. Now, I don't believe the vaccine is the mark of the beast. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there are other things that could cause you to be marginalized and not be able to participate in the economy in the same way as if you complied. So, I mean, non-compliance doesn't necessarily mean that you don't use cash or that you do use cash. There's no mention of cash in the passage at all. It could simply be that if you are such an outstanding nonconformist to the beast system as not to participate in it, not comply with it, well, people just won't do business with you. That has certainly happened many times in history where either Christians or sometimes Jews were not allowed to participate in the economy because of their religion, and they were under persecution. And that could happen again. So, I mean, Revelation 13 is the only place that mentions that without the mark of the beast, people not be able to buy or sell. And the idea that this is predicting a cashless society is one theory that has become extremely popular in dispensational circles. And it might be correct because that would certainly meet the conditions. I mean, if there is a cashless society and they won't let you buy or sell unless you take a credit number, I mean, obviously, that would fit the bill, but it's not the only imaginable thing that could fit the bill. The passage may refer to something entirely different. So we can't really say that the Bible predicts a cashless society. Even if there was a cashless society, I'm sure many people would be able to get along by bartering and things like that. So it's not as if you couldn't buy or sell unless it became illegal to do business with non-compliant people. And that could be, I mean, in Germany, in the Nazi time, I believe that it became illegal. If not illegal, it was simply not acceptable to do business with the Jews and their businesses. And So, I mean, persecution sometimes takes that form. I think what Revelation is talking about is persecution, persecution of Christians who are not complying with the system of the beast. And whether that involves a cashless society that we're not complying with, I don't know. But I don't believe that it could be only that. In other words, unless it involves specific compromise of your Christian values or your Christian testimony, I don't see why a person would go to the lake of fire for having taken the mark of the beast. That is to say, I don't think the lake of fire is made for people who pay their bills in a different currency than the normal. The Bible doesn't indicate that using gold or silver or paper money are, you know, somehow a moral thing that God wants everyone to comply with, and that when the time comes that people are using mere credit, that somehow that's a violation of Christianity, and therefore people lose their salvation for it. It seems to me that it's not that the people are persecuted in a sense, that they don't take the mark of the beast, and then they're persecuted and go to hell if they do comply with the beast. I think it all has to do with accepting the system, going along with the system, and people being ousted and ostracized from the system if they don't comply. And compliance then would have to in some way be a renunciation of their Christianity, because God doesn't send Christians to hell, especially not on the basis of whether they paid for their groceries with cash or with credit. I don't think that would have anything to do with God's value system. So, no, the cashless society is not at all mentioned in the Bible.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking my call, Steve.
Okay, Randall. Thanks for your call. Our next caller is Wyatt from Atlanta, Georgia. Wyatt, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Good day. The other day I was listening to your program, and a caller mentioned that you had expounded before on, I think, was hell not being eternal or forever, or either Satan would not be cast into hell forever. Would you expound on that? I missed that session.
Well, I know that Satan would not be cast into hell. Is that what you said?
He would not be cast into hell forever.
Well,
one of the two.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been me. I wouldn't say that Satan would not be cast into hell forever. It does appear in the Bible that he's cast into hell forever in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 10. So that would seem, you know, depending on how literal that is. But as far as hell for people being a place of eternal torment or not, all I have said is that there are three different views on that. There always have been. From the earliest times of the church to the present, there Christians have held three different views about whether hell is a place of eternal torment or not. In fact, I wrote a book on that over 10 years ago called Hell, Three Christian Views. So you're certainly welcome to get that. I don't sell books. So if someone wants to hear what the three views are and what the arguments are for each of them, I have a lecture at the website. I don't know if you've been to our website, thenarrowpath.com. If you go there, there's a tab that says topical lectures. And among the lectures, there's two lectures called Three Views of Hell. There's part one and part two. And that goes into the different views of hell that are out there and what the arguments are for each one. But I haven't put my approval on any of them.
Okay. All right. I'll go to the website and check it out.
All right, brother. Thanks for your
call.
Thanks
so much.
All right.
Okay, you're welcome.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. Let's talk to Elijah from Albany, Oregon. Hi, Elijah.
All right, brother.
Hey, yeah, you're listening to your radio. You need to be listening to your phone if you're going to be on the air here.
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, hello. This is Elijah Cook. This is my first time calling, and I was listening on the radio because it's louder. I'm in a tractor right now. But my question is, I've just started attending Calvary Chapel in Corvallis. Uh-huh. I have come to the understanding that you were like an elder or a deacon there. And I was just wondering or curious of why you left. And I believe Sorry, I'm nervous, but this is yes. Just can you answer,
I'll answer that question?
I believe.
I'll answer that question. Sure. Well, first of all, I've never was. I never was an elder or deacon at Calvary Chapel of Corvallis, Oregon. I did live in McMinnville, Oregon, and had friends who went to Corvallis Calvary Chapel. And there was even a time when there was some discussion of they have a Bible school there, at least they did back when I was living in Oregon, and they were going to allow me to debate David Hawking, actually, at their Bible school, which I wanted to do, and it didn't happen because, well, there was a conflict of schedule and it didn't happen. But I've met the pastor there at a dinner, but I know, no, he would not want to, he wouldn't want me to own me as a former elder or deacon there because my eschatology is different than Calvary Chapel's. I was an elder, and I was the primary teaching elder at a Calvary Chapel in Santa Cruz, California, back in the early 80s. That's before I moved to Oregon. And, of course, I was I attended Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa in the early Jesus Movement for the first 5 years of the Jesus Movement under Chuck Smith and Lonnie and those guys. I was in the church there, but I was just a teenager most of that time. But, yeah, it wasn't until I moved to Santa Cruz that I was actually an elder in Calvary Chapel. But I never was by the time I moved to Oregon, I was not in Calvary Chapel anymore. Now, you wonder why I'm not there. Well, you know, I don't go where I'm not welcome. That's really pretty much the answer. I love Calvary Chapel just fine. Chuck Smith was a great man and my mentor, and I have a very high regard for him. The pastor that I served under in Santa Cruz at Calvary Chapel was a wonderful man, a godly man, and we got along just fine. Calvary Chapel began to be very, what should I say, standardized in what theology they were going to stand for, and what they would not permit in Calvary Chapel, and eventually those definitions ruled me out. My eschatology, my end times views are different, and while you know, I think a Calvary Chapel would let me attend if they don't know who I am and I never say anything. I have visited Calvary Chapels, and even when I was in McMinnville, Oregon, running my school, the Calvary Chapel pastor there in McMinnville and I were friends, and I even had him come and teach my school some of the books of the Bible. But he would, and he even had me come once when he was absent to teach a midweek class on, I think it was on cults, on Mormonism or something like that. So we had a good relationship, but it would have made him uncomfortable for me to be a part of the church there because, frankly, Calvary Chapel is very committed to dispensationalism, and as many denominations are, by the way, many Baptist denominations are, certainly the Assemblies of God are. There's lots of denominations that are committed to dispensationalism, but as time went on, Calvary Chapel's views on that became defining of their movement. It's not so much the case with some of the other denominations that are dispensational. They hold that view, but they have other things that define them more. Eventually, Calvary Chapel was defined almost entirely by its dispensational eschatology. And that's one area I disagree with them on. I actually have a lot of areas I do agree with Chuck Smith and Calvary Chapel on. But since the one area that they've decided is how they're going to define themselves in the body of Christ happens to be one of the areas where I'm not in agreement, I don't have any, I would not be welcome there. I was never kicked out. I was never kicked out of Calvary Chapel. It's just that when I moved to Oregon, there wasn't a Calvary Chapel in the town I moved to. And there was no reason, when I did move to a town that had a Calvary Chapel, there was no reason to go into it because by this time Calvary, was not interested in non-denominational teachers being in their movement. So that'd be the answer to your question. Right? I guess he's gone. Okay, let's talk next to Barbara from Michigan. Barbara, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Steve. I have a question regarding, like, King Ahasuerus and Esther and how he was able to try out all the virgins and pick which ones he wants.
You want me to spell it out? Want me to spell it out? How do you think he tried out all the virgins?
Well, he tried them out, but the question is, why wasn't this condemned as fornication? And were other noblemen able to do the same thing? And did this ever get condemned, or was this just something the king could do? Because I just find this, I'm still trying to process this.
Is
this something other noblemen could do? Or?
Well, one reason it wasn't condemned as fornication is because it was in Persia. It was not in Israel. And therefore, God's standards of morality were not practiced, and no one was condemned for behaving like pagans, because they were, in fact, pagans. Everyone who's not Israel was a pagan, and therefore, not only did King Ahasuerus, have a large harem, he also probably had a lot of gods that he worshipped. That would have been very strictly, in fact, in Israel, the worship of the other gods would have been a more serious infraction of Jewish law than having a large harem, because actually nothing in the Old Testament would have condemned directly a king having a harem, or even an ordinary Jew having more than one wife, though most Jews didn't want more than one wife. Most Jews were peasants and couldn't afford to raise more than one family, but some rich men, especially if their first wife was barren and couldn't give them a son, they would sometimes take a second wife or try to have a child through one of their concubines. Now, a concubine was sort of like a wife, too, but usually a concubine was a slave girl who was taken as a wife and still in kind of a status a little lower than a free woman who was a wife. So when we read that Solomon, for example, who was in Israel, had 700 wives and 300 concubines, you say, well, what's the difference between a wife and a concubine? Not very much, except that a concubine was a kind of a slave. And one might even say a sex slave, but really I think more than that, the concubines, it wasn't so much that the man just wanted to have sex with a lot of women, although some of them did probably, but many times it was because they're seeking children. A wife and a concubine, both were seen as a means for a man to leave offspring for the next generation to carry on his name and his inheritance. And we don't view wives and women that way now. Fortunately, the Christian ethic has prevailed in Western civilization, where that would have been considered, inappropriate. But back in ancient times, it really wasn't. And the Bible in the Old Testament didn't say that a man had to only have one wife. The Old Testament did, in fact, model monogamy when God made Adam and Eve, even though he wanted them to have children, and he wanted them to have a lot of kids. He wanted them to fill the whole earth with their children, yet he gave Adam only one wife, which would certainly slow the thing down, in contrast to having a lot of wives, because he could have a lot of kids in a short time with a lot of wives. But God obviously believed in monogamy, but he didn't command monogamy. He created monogamous marriage, and Jesus, eventually, in Matthew 19, was talking about that when they were asking if it's okay to divorce your wife. Now, Jesus said if you divorce your wife for any cause other than her unfaithfulness and you marry another one, you're committing adultery. Now, that's interesting because in the Old Testament, a man could marry as many wives as he wanted to without being accused of adultery, as long as he was taking them as real wives and committed them for life, like a husband to them. But Jesus said to the Pharisees, didn't you read how it was when God made things in the beginning? He made a man and a woman, and he said, for this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So Jesus said God made things monogamous. He didn't command it to be monogamous in the Old Testament, but he made it that way, and Jesus said that's how he made it, that's what he wanted, and that's what we should seek to do. We should probably, in all things in our lives, including marriage, try to get as close to the divine model and the perfect will of God as we can. And so in the New Testament, there's no approval of polygamy. In the Old Testament, though, it was something that was permitted. And a lot of times, even some of the godliest men had more than one wife. Abraham did. Jacob did. Samuel's father, Elkanah. We don't know much about him, but he seemed to be a godly man. David had more than one wife, and none of them were condemned for that. Although it would appear that in most of the cases, before David anyway, a man usually took a second wife because his first wife was barren. And sometimes it was even the wife who suggested, hey, I'm not able to have any kids here. Why don't you have children by this person? And there was definitely a different mentality that men and women had about marriage in those ancient times. We have to remember, we're talking about ancient Bedouin Middle Eastern people 4,000 years ago. I mean, even American culture was different 400 years ago. If you go that far out of America back to the Middle East, to go back 4,000 years, we shouldn't be surprised that their culture had different views about certain things. And for a man to have multiple wives, especially if it was only to have try to get a family going, wasn't considered to be, rude to his first wife. It wasn't considered to be immoral. But now when David had like 8 wives and Solomon had 1,000 almost, well, that was excessive. And they, that definitely was not specifically condemned as a practice, but although in Deuteronomy, God had said that the kings of Israel should not multiply wives. I would say, Elkanah, who took a second wife, might be adding wives, not multiplying wives. When you get 700 wives, I'd say that's multiplication. So, there was some disobedience there on that part. But Ahasuerus wasn't even under that system. He was a pagan. So, yeah, he took a lot of girls in, and they became his concubines. It's not like he took all the pretty girls out of the houses, slept with them, and sent them home to their parents. No, they became his permanent concubines, although in many cases it says he didn't sleep with them a second time. He was, he kept them as, part of the king's household, but they weren't his mates until, that is, after he rejected them from being the queen. Anyway, that does seem very strange to our ears as Christians and even as Westerners, because, of course, we're culturally very far removed from that, and we also have the New Testament giving us a far better understanding of what the ideal is for marriage. All right, let's talk to Susan from the state of Maine. Hi, Susan, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. So last week, I'm not sure if you want to discuss this any further, but last week someone called in and it was a question on organ donation and whether, I guess they thought it was okay with their religion or whatever. So I just wanted to ask if you wanted a few facts on that.
You could give me some. Someone actually texted me with something from YouTube about that just the other day. But I didn't have a chance to watch it. But from what I understand, it was someone against organ donation. What I said is I don't know enough about it. I don't know of anything in the Bible that would forbid it, for the simple reason that in biblical times, they didn't have that possibility. But go ahead. Tell me more.
So I'll give you a quick setup. So when someone is in a car accident or someone dies, first-time responders go there, and if they have that card and they have ID that says they're an organ donor and they could be pronounced dead, maybe change of color, no heartbeat, they will intubate them, put that tube down their throat. They will manual ventilate them until they get into a hospital, and then we will put them on a ventilator. Now, they can be, and the reason for that is to keep all their organs from going into shock or, not being good. So it's, you're playing with minutes. Maybe the most is 20 minutes or 30. But then eventually they do a brain dead test. So if you have no EEGs and you don't have brain waves that says you are brain dead, the ventilation is keeping you alive. So that's a pressure ventilation that puts air into your lungs, keeps your circulation up to go through all your organs. They're oxygenated. And so that's what that's all about. My opinion as a Christian, just make sure everything's well with your soul. I believe that your spirit does leave your body at time of death. I'm not going to say it's 20 seconds, 2 minutes, or 5 minutes, but, that's just a small synopsis of what it is all about.
I hear you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I think the person who sent me a YouTube thing, which I only read the synopsis of it, I think they were against organ donation kind of for the same reason, and that is that I didn't realize this, that they do keep the body, at least artificially, alive long enough to get the organs. I had never known anything about organ donation, but I had assumed that they would take the organs after the person was dead. But I think the impression I got from this other point of view was that the person that they take it from is actually alive, even if they're keeping them artificially alive. But I have no idea. I mean, this is really beyond my expertise. I don't really know anything about how they do things and so forth. But I would say, yeah, if you're not ready to die, you probably shouldn't donate organs, because I've heard that in a situation where a bunch of people are injured, the medics often will do triage to save the people who aren't donors. I've heard that from certain sources. So I don't know much about the whole thing. Anyway, thank you for your input. I need to take a break here. We have another half hour coming up. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are on Monday through Friday for an hour each weekday, taking your calls. We are listener supported. If you'd like to write to us to help support us, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. I'll be right back. Don't go away.
The Narrow Path is one feature of the teaching ministry of Steve Gregg. Steve's philosophy of teaching is to educate, not indoctrinate, his listeners. He believes that Christians should learn to think for themselves about the Bible and not be dependent on him or any other teacher for their convictions. We hope to teach Christians how to think, not what to think about the Bible.
Welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we have another half hour coming up. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith you'd like to raise, we can talk about them here. The number to call, we have a couple lines open. You can call this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our next caller today is Bill from Fullerton, California. Bill, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have one question relating to apologetics. When I say apologetics, I would mean, you know, our own personal conversations that we have with other folks. Uh-huh. So my question is the Bible the only text or the only reference book or book that shows that miracles have been performed by religious leaders, such as, you know, the Lord and prophets? Or are there other religious books out there that also cite miracle working?
Well, I sometimes miracles are claimed in other religions, but I'm not sure whether they are listed in their holy books. I don't believe the Quran mentions Muhammad working miracles, but I think that sometime after his death, many legends about him working miracles were, you know, promoted. I think there are legends of Muhammad, like miracles do come from the lifetime of Jesus or of the apostles. In the Hindu, there's a lot of legends of different things. Most of them don't have any historical basis at all. They're just mythology. There are miraculous things that are attributed to Krishna and to some of the other gods. Likewise, you know, the Greek myths of the gods on Mount Olympus. A lot of pagan religions have at least what we call supernatural things in them. As far as their founders, some of these religions, I don't know if they really, who is the founder of Hinduism? There's not one person, you know, who's the founder of the Greek pantheon. These things are just things that developed in a culture and don't really have founders, and they don't really have historical roots. They're stories and myths that grew up in a culture about, in most cases, beings that never existed in history. a difference in Christianity is that Christ did exist in history. You don't need the Bible to tell you that. He's referenced in other historical sources not long after his lifetime. Some of them Jewish, which were hostile to him, and some of them Roman, which were also hostile to him. And yet these hostile historians and witnesses have made reference to him as an existing character. The only real, you know, comprehensive or slightly comprehensive stories we have of what he taught and did actually come from people who believed in him, which is what you'd expect. If he did the things that are recorded and someone knew it to record them, how would they not be a believer? You know, sometimes people say, well, you can't trust the Gospels because they're just written by people who believe. Well, doesn't that tell you something? If they believe, doesn't that mean they're telling you things that they believe happened and that those things that happened are the reason for their believing it? You know, I mean, how would you expect it to be otherwise?
I think so, most impressive, I mean, the Bible's, too, are that... Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say, the most impressive things to me are what's written by non-Christian historians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Either witnessing
Josephus
things
and
or whatever.
Tacitus and Suetonius.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's, I was going to say Josephus for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Josephus mentions Jesus. Suetonius and Tacitus, the Roman historians, mention either him or the movement that was started and mentions that he was crucified by Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius Caesar and so forth. The Talmud even has mention of him. Talmud is not a history. It's Jewish traditions and so forth, but they mention him, but only, you know, very negatively, because the Jews do not think well of Jesus.
Christ as performing magic. They're careful not to say,
right,
you know, black magic, evil magic.
They call him a sorcerer.
So interesting.
They call him a sorcerer, and they say he was crucified for sorcery, which is interesting because, you know, sometimes skeptics will say, well, Jesus never did anything supernatural. Those are just legends that were formed about him, you know, in the second, third centuries and so forth. As Christians began to make up the stories, they began to make up these miracles. But the Talmud actually comes from around the time of Jesus, and they couldn't deny that he did supernatural things, but they called them magic instead of miracles. So, I mean, the Talmud itself, in a backhanded sort of way, kind of confirms that Jesus was a miracle worker. Yeah, but
well,
other religions,
Steve,
I don't know if their holy books record it.
Yeah. All right, well, I'll try to get out to see you when you come out to... where is it out here? I know you have it every third Saturday, but I'll try to make
Buena
the next
Park.
One.
I was just there 2 days ago. Yeah. All right. God bless you. Good talking to you. All right. Bert from the San Francisco Bay Area. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I wanted to get your perspective. Hi. Of, I know that in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 20, God actually commanded the Israelites to kill, you know, nations of people, i.e. Canaanites, Amorites, Hittites, etc. I'm trying to reconcile, like, in light of today's war, are the Israelites justified in killing the Palestinians in terms of connecting the dots to the Old Testament, and how does that relate to, like, premillennialism, dispensationalism, amillennialism? And so I was just wondering if you could give me your perspective on that.
Well, I would say the Jews are as justified in fighting defensive wars as any nation is justified in fighting defensive wars. In the Old Testament, the conquest wars of Canaan were not defensive wars. God had revealed that the Canaanites were doing such abominable things that they were a lot like Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, God wiped out everybody in Sodom and Gomorrah himself with fire and brimstone. But the Canaanites were about on the same level, and it was time for them to be wiped out too. But God didn't use fire and brimstone. He used the Jews. They weren't called Jews then. They were called Israel. And they went in, and they were doing God's work at his command. Of course, lots of people may doubt that, but I believe the Bible. The Bible does say that God gave them that command. He said it's not because Israel was so good, but because the nations were so wicked, he said, that he's having them do that. Now, we have no such statement from God about the Palestinians. And I don't know any Palestinians. I do know there's obviously terrorists among them. There are also terrorists, or at least former terrorists, among the Jews. I mean, there's Jews had terrorist activities too. Menachem Begin ran a terrorist organization in the 1940s called Ergun, and they did awful terrorist things just like Hamas does now. Now, I don't know that the Jews do terrorism anymore. I don't know what they do now. Of course, they've accomplished their goals. They have the state of Israel, so they're not trying to take it now, but because they took it earlier. But now the terrorism looks like a lot of it comes from the other side. But it was from both sides. Through the past 75 years, there's been terrorism on both sides. But one thing we can say is that neither side are Christian. Neither side are following orders from God. Mm. You know, people who follow orders from God receive Christ, because that's the main commandment. This is his commandment, that we love one another and, you know, that we believe in Jesus Christ. 1 John tells us. So, you know, neither Israel as a nation nor the Palestinians as a group believe in Christ. I will say this, the percentage of Palestinians who do believe in Christ, though it's a small percentage, is much larger than the percentage of Jewish Israelis who believe in Christ. Much larger. Mm. Christianity exists among the Palestinians. It also exists in Israel, but it's not very well. I mean, there's only a 0.5% of the Jewish Israelis are Christian. That's one person out of 200 in Israel. Mm-hmm. And in Palestine, among Palestinians, like 7% are Christian. So a lot more. Anyway. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Do you think the dispensationalists, I hear them saying that Israel is the chosen people, therefore we stand with Israel, therefore, you know, Hamas should be completely eradicated. They believe what you just mentioned?
Or dispensationalists? Who knows what they would say? Most of them don't think very clearly about these things. If they say Israel's the chosen people, chosen for what? If someone's chosen, what are they chosen for? If somebody says God chose Israel for salvation, that's not true. The Bible never says that God chose Israel for salvation. When Abraham was chosen to bring forth the seed that became Israel, God said he was chosen to be a blessing to all nations, not simply to receive blessing and go to heaven when they died. That kind of choosing wasn't happening in the Old Testament. God chose Israel to receive revelation from God and to make him known to the nations, which they didn't do for the most part until Jesus came. And, of course, Jesus fulfilled that. But they were also chosen to bring Jesus into the world, to bring the Messiah into the world, which they did. And, mission accomplished. But since Jesus came, there's nothing in the Bible that suggests they're chosen for anything in particular. So to call them chosen people, we might say their ancestors were chosen, like before the time of Christ. Their ancestors were chosen for the mission of bringing the Messiah into the world to bless all the nations. That's what the choice was for. They were chosen for this responsibility, not for privilege. There were privileges that God promised them if they were obedient, and curses that would come upon them if they were disobedient. That's what God said. But they were chosen as a nation to be the one that would bring the Messiah into the world, which they did. Now, you won't find anything in the Bible that says they're chosen for any special mission after that point. So I don't know in what way people would say they're chosen people, especially since 99.5% of them reject Jesus Christ. I mean, how can a person that means if they die, they're not saved. How can people be called chosen people if they're going to go to hell? I don't really understand what kind of choosing we're talking about here. People who say that simply are not thinking very well. They're saying talking points that belong to the dispensational camp, but they're not really thinking about what they're saying and what it means. They're just kind of, they just repeat talking points.
I got you, Steve. Thank you for providing clarity. God bless you. Appreciate it.
All right. God bless you, Bert. All right. So let's see. We're going to talk next to Sherry from Camino Island, Washington.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Steve. I just finished listening to your Survey of Revelation on YouTube. It's a three-part series. You did it in 2020. And I was wondering, because the amillennial view looks a lot at 70 AD, and that doesn't work if we're looking at, I believe it's 96 AD, that a lot of people say that Revelation was written.
Uh-huh.
Is that correct?
Correct, correct.
So I'm wondering how they determine the dates.
Okay. Well, just so people will know what you're talking about, of course, many of our listeners do know, but there's probably people just tuning in who have no idea what we're talking about here. The question of the date of when Revelation was written has been disputed for centuries. And two major views on the date of writing are there's an early date and a late date. The early date has Revelation written during the time of Nero, who died in 68 A.D., so written in the late 60s. The other date is the later date, that it was written late in Domitian's reign, which would be maybe around 95, 96 AD. Now, what this affects is that there are several different views of Revelation that are vying for prominence. There's some people believe Revelation's talking about the end times. That's called the futures view. Some believe it's talking about the whole church age in a panoramic sort of style. That's called the historist view. Some believe it's talking about the whole church age from a spiritual, symbolic point of view. That's called the idealist view. And some believe it's mostly about the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, which is called the preterist view. Now, the preterist view, obviously, could only be true if Revelation is written before Jerusalem fell, because you're not going to have a whole book of prophecy predicting something that already happened. There'd be no use for it. So the preterist view holds that Revelation was written before 70 AD, and therefore it chooses the early date, in the reign of Nero. So sometime in the late 60s, the preterist believes. Now, the other three views... They're entitled. They can take the early view or the later view, and it won't matter. You could believe it's about the end times. You could believe it's the whole church age. And you could believe it's early date written or late date written. But only the preterist view, because it thinks that the book of Revelation is predicting the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, only the preterist view really demands the early date. Because if the late date is true, then preterism can't be true. If the book is written in 96 AD, it clearly is not going to be predicting something that happened a quarter of a century earlier. So that's the thing. Now, you ask, is there any way of knowing what the date is? Well, if there was a way of knowing with certainty, this debate would have ended, and it has not. There are many evidences that each side presents in favor of their view. The early date view has quite a few evidences, and the late date view has quite a few evidences. I can see this. First of all, my book, Revelation 4, introduction goes all the essential arguments for the late date and for the early date. I give the case for both views of the date in my book, Revelation 4 Views, a Parallel Commentary. But since you probably don't have the book, I was just going to say that the evidence for the early date appears to be based almost entirely on things internal within the book. That is, there are things in the book that only make sense if it was written before AD 70. And there's just a little bit of testimony of the early church that sounds like it supports the early date too. Now, when it comes to the late date, most of the evidence is from outside the book. Most of it is what church fathers said about it. And there's also a little bit of internal evidence inside the book that they use, but it's not very, to my mind, the internal evidence for the late date is not strong at all. To me, it's very forced. But there is a fairly strong external case, meaning what the church fathers said about the book, that points toward the late date. So just to kind of summarize it, the evidence for the date of writing is of two types. There is internal evidence, which is the things you get from inside the book itself, the things it says about itself that seems to point to its date. Then there's external evidence, which means it's people outside the book of Revelation, usually the church fathers, who say things about when it was written. Now, the internal evidence largely supports the early date. The external evidence, in many respects, supports the later date. I myself feel that the internal evidence bears more weight than the external evidence, and therefore I incline to the early date. But I would say very quickly that there's no absolute proof of either the early or the later date. But the later date is more popular today. And like the dispensationalists and the futurists who believe Revelation is about the end times, they'll always go for the late date, although they don't need it. If the futurist view is true, it could be true whether it was written in the book of during the time of Domitian or whether it's written in the book at the time of Nero. It doesn't matter when it was written. If it's talking about things 2,000 years off, it could have been written in either of those times. But because the futurist really wants to do their best to eliminate the possibility of the preterist view, they are very, very staunch on the late date. I mean, more than they need to be, but they are. They fear the competition of the preterist view. So they feel like, well, we'll just eliminate that by eliminating the early date. Well, if you can eliminate the early date, you certainly have eliminated preterism. But eliminating the early date is a lot harder than they think it is.
Okay, well, I've been listening to you for a long time, and I just started watching online on YouTube. That's just recently. So, I like the preterist view. I've enjoyed your teachings, and it's difficult to find fault with them. I always wondered about that date thing, because I know if it's 70 AD, the preterist view kind of doesn't fly. That's right.
So I'll tell you this. If you get my book, Revelation 4 Views,
most people are glad they got it.
Okay. Well, in the introduction there's a section called the date of writing, which goes through the evidences for the two different dates.
Well, I started it. Started reading your book, but I'm not much of
a
reader, so I'm so glad
that you're
online.
The introduction is 50 pages long. Yeah, the introduction is 50 pages long, so I appreciate that you might not have gotten through it, but anyway, that's where you look it up. You'll find the evidence there.
Well, thank you for being online as well. I appreciate that, because I'm more of a visual learner than reading, so having problems with my eyes. All right. Well, thank you so much, Steve. I really have appreciated your ministry.
All right. Well, God bless you. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk to Dave from Shoreline, Washington, another Washington caller, two in a row. Hello.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a young friend that's interested in John Piper, and he's selling this thing he calls Christian hedonism. Have you heard of this?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you talk about Christian hedonism, I mean, hedonism sounds bad, but I think John Piper uses that expression just to be provocative. What he means is, a hedonist is a person who seeks pleasure, okay, who just is a pleasure seeker. And when he's talking about Christian hedonism, he's really talking about finding pleasure in God. In fact, isn't his ministry called Enjoying God or something like that? It has to do with finding enjoyment and pleasure in the spiritual pursuit of God, which is certainly not anything I would criticize. I disagree with Piper on his Calvinism, of course, but I don't find any objection to his term Christian hedonism. I never would have chosen the term, even though I also think that Christians should enjoy God. I think a relationship with God should be your highest pleasure. In his presence are pleasures forevermore, or I should say a fullness of joy, and at his right hand are pleasures forevermore, David said in Psalm 16. So, I'm not critical of that. It struck me as sort of an attempt to make sort of a clever and provocative phrase, but when you know what he means by it, there's nothing objectionable about it. And I didn't think it was really that clever, but so don't worry about that. Okay?
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. God bless you, Dave. All right. Mary from Santa Cruz, California, my old stomping grounds from the old days. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Steve. I've been with the news lately and these things going on in Israel. It just seems like the dispensational question seems to be coming up a lot more because people are siding with Israel, and well, the dispensationalists generally are siding with Israel, taking a stand there.
Right.
And it's kind of calling attention to the doctrines of dispensationalism, which you have very thoroughly and completely explained to most of us here. So my question is, what relationship did Scofield have to Darby and the Bible that he, what was the backing of Scofield writing the study Bible?
Yeah, well, Scofield, I don't think Scofield ever knew Darby. I don't know if their lifespans overlapped. I think Darby died before Scofield was in the picture, but he definitely bought into Darby's doctrines. And Scofield was a lawyer, actually. He was not a trained theologian. He was a lawyer. But I've read different things that I cannot confirm, and I don't want to pass along rumors that are not vetted. But there are people who have written saying that Scofield was approached, by Zionists or by someone other, someone else, on Israel's side, to take Darby's views and insert them into the notes of a study Bible, and thus the Scofield Study Bible was created. Now, I don't know that he was approached by it. Some say he was paid to do that. I mean, that may be true. I'm not saying it isn't true, but I'm not affirming it. All I know is that he wrote his Bible in order to promote Darbyism or dispensationalism. And he was very much part of the burgeoning dispensational movement in America. Darby, of course, was from England, or I think he was Irish, but it was in America.
He was.
Yeah.
He was Irish.
Right. In America, dispensationalism was taking hold, and Scofield was right in the middle of the Bible, Bible study movement that was pushing dispensationalism at conferences, Bible conferences, and so forth. And then, of course, the Bible colleges movement, like Dallas Theological Seminary and Moody and Multnomah and a lot of other Bible colleges were started to promote Darbyism too. But Scofield's Bible seemed to be one of the biggest influences for Darbyism in America in the early 1900s. His first one came out, I believe, was in 1909. By the time I got a Scofield Bible, they had come out with the new Scofield, which was updated. Not so much that his notes were updated. It came out in 67, I think, but I don't think his notes were much different, but they updated the English of the King James in it. But I wore out 4 Scofield Bibles when I was young. Because I read them so much.
I threw mine away.
Yeah. Well, I threw mine away when it was worn out, when the covers were falling off, Chuck Smith was my mentor, and he used the Scofield Bible. But of course, when I left dispensationalism, I didn't buy another Scofield Bible. I have one on my shelf right now, but I haven't used it for a long time. But yeah, Scofield was the big promoter in America of that doctrine. One of the big ones.
Okay. Well, the whistling's coming, so I'll let you go, Steve. Thank you.
Okay, Mary. God bless you. Thanks for calling. Bye. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. There's thousands of lectures there. They're all free at thenarrowpath.com. And you can donate if you wish. Bye now.